This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. Written by Steven Pinker. Narrated by Victor Baveen.
Preface. Not another book on nature and nurture. Are there really people out there who still believe that the mind is a blank slate? Isn't it obvious to anyone with more than one child, to anyone who has been in a heterosexual relationship, or to anyone who has noticed that children learn language but house pets don't, that people are born with certain talents and temperaments? Haven't we all moved beyond the simplistic dichotomy between heredity and environment, and realize that all behavior comes out of an interaction between the two? This is the kind of reaction I got from colleagues when I explained my plans for this book. At first glance, the reaction is not unreasonable. Maybe nature versus nurture is a dead issue. Anyone familiar with current writings on mind and behavior has seen claims to the middle ground like these. If the reader is now convinced that either the genetic or environmental explanation has won out to the exclusion of the other, we have not done a sufficiently good job of presenting one side or the other. It seems highly likely to us that both genes and environment have something to do with this issue. What might the mix be? We are resolutely agnostic on that issue. As far as we can determine, the evidence does not yet justify an estimate. This is not going to be one of those books that says everything is genetic. It isn't. The environment is just as important as the genes. The things children experience while they are growing up are just as important as the things they are born with. Even when a behavior is heritable, an individual's behavior is still a product of development, and thus, it has a causal environmental component. The modern understanding of how phenotypes are inherited through the replication of both genetic and environmental conditions suggests that cultural traditions, behaviors copied by children from their parents, are likely to be crucial. If you think these are innocuous compromises that show that everyone has outgrown the nature-nurture debate, think again. The quotations come, in fact, from three of the most incendiary books of the last decade. The first is from The Bell Curve, by Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, who argue that the difference in average IQ scores between American blacks and American whites has both genetic and environmental causes. The second is from The Nurture Assumption by Judith Rich Harris, who argues that children's personalities are shaped by their genes as well as by their environments, so similarities between children and their parents may come from their shared genes and not just from the effects of parenting. The third is from A Natural History of Rape by Randy Thornhill and Craig Palmer, who argue that rape is not simply a product of culture, but also has roots in the nature of men's sexuality. For invoking nurture and nature, not nurture alone, these authors have been picketed, shouted down, subjected to searing invective in the press, even denounced in Congress. Others expressing such opinions have been censored, assaulted, or threatened with criminal prosecution. The idea that nature and nurture interact to shape some part of the mind might turn out to be wrong, but it is not wishy-washy or unexceptionable, even in the 21st century, thousands of years after the issue was framed. When it comes to explaining human thought and behavior, the possibility that heredity plays any role at all still has the power to shock. To acknowledge human nature, many think, is to endorse racism, sexism, war, greed, genocide, nihilism, reactionary politics, and neglect of children and the disadvantaged. Any claim that the mind has an innate organization strikes people not as a hypothesis that might be incorrect, but as a thought it is immoral to think. This book is about the moral, emotional, and political colorings of the concept of human nature in modern life. I will retrace the history that led people to see human nature as a dangerous idea. And I will try to unsnarl the moral and political rat's nests that have entangled the idea along the way. Though no book on human nature can hope to be uncontroversial, I did not write it to be yet another explosive book, as dust jackets tend to say. I am not, as many people assume, countering an extreme nurture position with an extreme nature position, with the truth lying somewhere in between. In some cases, an extreme environmentalist explanation is correct. Which language you speak is an obvious example, and differences among races and ethnic groups in test scores may be another. In other cases, such as certain inherited neurological disorders, an extreme hereditarian explanation is correct. In most cases, the correct explanation will invoke a complex interaction between heredity and environment. Culture is crucial, but culture could not exist without mental faculties that allow humans to create and learn culture to begin with. My goal in this book is not to argue that genes are everything and culture is nothing. No one believes that. But to explore why the extreme position, that culture is everything, is so often seen as moderate, and the moderate position is seen as extreme. Nor does acknowledging human nature have the political implications so many fear. It does not, for example, require one to abandon feminism, or to accept current levels of inequality or violence, or to treat morality as a fiction. For the most part, I will try not to advocate particular policies or to advance the agenda of the political left or right. I believe that controversies about policy almost always involve trade-offs between competing values, and that science is equipped to identify the trade-offs but not to resolve them. Many of these trade-offs, I will show, arise from features of human nature, and by clarifying them, I hope to make our collective choices, whatever they are, better informed. If I am an advocate, it is for discoveries about human nature that have been ignored or suppressed in modern discussions of human affairs. Why is it important to sort this all out? The refusal to acknowledge human nature is like the Victorians' embarrassment about sex, only worse. It distorts our science and scholarship, our public discourse, and our day-to-day lives. Logicians tell us that a single contradiction can corrupt a set of statements and allow falsehoods to proliferate through it. The dogma that human nature does not exist, in the face of evidence from science and common sense that it does, is just such a corrupting influence. First, the doctrine that the mind is a blank slate has distorted the study of human beings, and thus the public and private decisions that are guided by that research. Many policies on parenting, for example, are inspired by research that finds a correlation between the behavior of parents and the behavior of children. Loving parents have confident children. Authoritative parents, neither too permissive nor too punitive, have well-behaved children. Parents who talk to their children have children with better language skills, and so on. Everyone concludes that to grow the best children, parents must be loving, authoritative, and talkative. And if children don't turn out well, it must be the parents' fault. But the conclusions depend on the belief that children are blank slates. Parents, remember, provide their children with genes, not just a home environment. The correlations between parents and children may be telling us only that the same genes that make adults loving, authoritative, and talkative make their children self-confident, well-behaved, and articulate. Until the studies are redone with adopted children, who get only their environment, not their genes, from their parents, the data are compatible with the possibility that genes make all the difference, the possibility that parenting makes all the difference, or anything in between. Yet in almost every instance, the most extreme position, that parents are everything, is the only one researchers entertain. The taboo on human nature has not just put blinkers on researchers, but turned any discussion of it into a heresy that must be stamped out. Many writers are so desperate to discredit any suggestion of an innate human constitution that they have thrown logic and civility out the window. Elementary distinctions. Some versus all. Probable versus always. Is versus ought. Are eagerly flouted to paint human nature as an extremist doctrine and thereby steer readers away from it. The analysis of ideas is commonly replaced by political smears and personal attacks. This poisoning of the intellectual atmosphere has left us unequipped to analyze pressing issues about human nature, just as new scientific discoveries are making them acute. The denial of human nature has spread beyond the academy and has led to a disconnect between intellectual life and common sense. I first had the idea of writing this book when I started a collection of astonishing claims from pundits and social critics about the malleability of the human psyche. That little boys quarrel and fight because they are encouraged to do so. That children enjoy sweets because their parents use them as a reward for eating vegetables. That teenagers get the idea to compete in looks and fashion from spelling bees and academic prizes. That men think the goal of sex is an orgasm because of the way they were socialized. The problem is not just that these claims are preposterous, but that the writers did not acknowledge they were saying things that common sense might call into question. This is the mentality of a cult in which fantastical beliefs are flaunted as proof of one's piety. That mentality cannot coexist with an esteem for the truth. And I believe it is responsible for some of the unfortunate trends in recent intellectual life. One trend is a stated contempt among many scholars for the concepts of truth, logic, and evidence. Another is a hypocritical divide between what intellectuals say in public and what they really believe. A third is the inevitable reaction. A culture of politically incorrect shock jocks who revel in anti-intellectualism and bigotry, emboldened by the knowledge that the intellectual establishment has forfeited claims to credibility in the eyes of the public. Finally, the denial of human nature has not just corrupted the world of critics and intellectuals, but has done harm to the lives of real people. The theory that parents can mold their children like clay has inflicted child-rearing regimes on parents that are unnatural and sometimes cruel. It has distorted the choices faced by mothers as they try to balance their lives, and multiplied the anguish of parents whose children haven't turned out the way they hoped. The belief that human tastes are reversible cultural preferences has led social planners to write off people's enjoyment of ornament, natural light, and human scale, and force millions of people to live in drab cement boxes. The romantic notion that all evil is a product of society has justified the release of dangerous psychopaths who promptly murdered innocent people, and the conviction that humanity could be reshaped by massive social engineering projects led to some of the greatest atrocities in history. Though many of my arguments will be coolly analytical, that an acknowledgement of human nature does not, logically speaking, imply the negative outcomes so many people fear, I will not try to hide my belief that they have a positive thrust as well. Man will become better when you show him what he is like, wrote Chekhov. And so the new sciences of human nature can help lead the way to a realistic, biologically informed humanism. They expose the psychological unity of our species beneath the superficial differences of physical appearance and parochial culture. They make us appreciate the wondrous complexity of the human mind, which we are apt to take for granted precisely because it works so well. They identify the moral intuitions that we can put to work in improving our lot. They promise a naturalness in human relationships, encouraging us to treat people in terms of how they do feel, rather than how some theory says they ought to feel. They offer a touchstone by which we can identify suffering and depression wherever they occur, unmasking the rationalizations of the powerful. They give us a way to see through the designs of self-appointed social reformers, who would liberate us from our pleasures. They renew our appreciation for the achievements of democracy and of the rule of law, and they enhance the insights of artists and philosophers who have reflected on the human condition for millennia. An honest discussion of human nature has never been more timely. Throughout the 20th century, many intellectuals tried to rest principles of decency on fragile factual claims, such as that human beings are biologically indistinguishable, harbor no ignoble motives, and are utterly free in their ability to make choices. These claims are now being called into question by discoveries in the sciences of mind, brain, genes, and evolution. If nothing else, the completion of the Human Genome Project, with its promise of an unprecedented understanding of the genetic roots of the intellect and the emotions, should serve as a wake-up call. The new scientific challenge to the denial of human nature leaves us with a challenge. If we are not to abandon values such as peace and equality, or our commitments to science and truth, then we must pry these values away from claims about our psychological makeup that are vulnerable to being proven false. This audiobook is for people who wonder where the taboo against human nature came from, and who are willing to explore whether the challenges to the taboo are truly dangerous or just unfamiliar. It is for those who are curious about the emerging portrait of our species and curious about the legitimate criticisms of that portrait. It is for those who suspect that the taboo against human nature has left us playing without a full deck as we deal with the pressing issues confronting us. And it is for those who recognize that the sciences of mind, brain, genes, and evolution are permanently changing our view of ourselves, and wonder whether the values we hold precious will wither, survive, or, as I will argue, be enhanced. Part 1. The Blank Slate, The Noble Savage, and The Ghost in the Machine. Everyone has a theory of human nature. Everyone has to anticipate the behavior of others. And that means we all need theories about what makes people tick. A tacit theory of human nature, that behavior is caused by thoughts and feelings, is embedded in the very way we think about people. We fill out this theory by introspecting on our own minds and assuming that our fellows are like ourselves, and by watching people's behavior and filing away generalizations. We absorb still other ideas from our intellectual climate, from the expertise of authorities and the conventional wisdom of the day. Our theory of human nature is the wellspring of much in our lives. We consult it when we want to persuade or threaten, inform or deceive. It advises us on how to nurture our marriages, bring up our children, and control our own behavior. Its assumptions about learning drive our educational policy. Its assumptions about motivation drive our policies on economics, law, and crime. And because it delineates what people can achieve easily, what they can achieve only with sacrifice or pain, and what they cannot achieve at all, it affects our values, what we believe we can reasonably strive for as individuals and as a society. Rival theories of human nature are entwined in different ways of life and different political systems, and have been a source of much conflict over the course of history. For millennia, the major theories of human nature have come from religion. The Judeo-Christian tradition, for example, offers explanations for much of the subject matter now studied by biology and psychology. Humans are made in the image of God and are unrelated to animals. Women are derivative of men and destined to be ruled by them. The mind is an immaterial substance. It has powers possessed by no purely physical structure and can continue to exist when the body dies. The mind is made up of several components, including a moral sense, an ability to love, a capacity for reason that recognizes whether an act conforms to ideals of goodness, and a decision faculty that chooses how to behave. Although the decision faculty is not bound by the laws of cause and effect, it has an innate tendency to choose sin. Our cognitive and perceptual faculties work accurately because God implanted ideals in them that correspond to reality, and because He coordinates their functioning with the outside world. Mental health comes from recognizing God's purpose choosing good and repenting sin, and loving God and one's fellow humans for God's sake. The Judeo-Christian theory is based on events narrated in the Bible. We know that the human mind has nothing in common with the minds of animals because the Bible says that humans were created separately. We know that the design of women is based on the design of men because in the second telling of the creation of women, Eve was fashioned from the rib of Adam. Human decisions cannot be the inevitable effects of some cause, we may surmise, because God held Adam and Eve responsible for eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, implying that they could have chosen otherwise. Women are dominated by men as punishment for Eve's disobedience, and men and women inherit the sinfulness of the first couple. The Judeo-Christian conception is still the most popular theory of human nature in the United States. According to recent polls, 76% of Americans believe in the biblical account of creation. 79% believe that the miracles in the Bible actually took place. 76% believe in angels, the devil, and other immaterial souls. 67% believe they will exist in some form after their death. And only 15% believe that Darwin's theory of evolution is the best explanation for the origin of human life on Earth. Politicians on the right embrace the religious theory explicitly, and no mainstream politician would dare contradict it in public. But the modern sciences of cosmology, geology, biology, and archaeology have made it impossible for a scientifically literate person to believe that the biblical story of creation actually took place. As a result, the Judeo-Christian theory of human nature is no longer explicitly avowed by most academics, journalists, social analysts, and other intellectually engaged people. Nonetheless, every society must operate with a theory of human nature, and our intellectual mainstream is committed to another one. The theory is seldom articulated or overtly embraced, but it lies at the heart of a vast number of beliefs and policies. Bertrand Russell wrote, "Every man, wherever he goes, is encompassed by a cloud of comforting convictions, which move with him like flies on a summer day." For intellectuals today, many of those convictions are about psychology and social relations. I will refer to those convictions as the blank slate, the idea that the human mind has no inherent structure and can be inscribed at will by society or ourselves. That theory of human nature, namely that it barely exists, is the topic of this book. Just as religions contain a theory of human nature, so theories of human nature take on some form of the functions of religion, and the blank slate has become the secular religion of modern intellectual life. It is seen as a source of values, so the fact that it is based on a miracle, a complex mind arising out of nothing, is not held against it. Challenges to the doctrine from skeptics and scientists have plunged some believers into a crisis of faith, and have led others to mount the kinds of bitter attacks ordinarily aimed at heretics and infidels. And just as many religious traditions eventually reconciled themselves to apparent threats from science, such as the revolutions of Copernicus and Darwin, so, I argue, will our values survive the demise of the blank slate. The chapters in this part of the audiobook, Part 1, are about the ascendance of the blank slate in modern intellectual life, and about the new view of human nature and culture that is beginning to challenge it. In succeeding parts, we will witness the anxiety evoked by this challenge, Part 2, and see how the anxiety may be assuaged, Part 3. Then I will show how a richer conception of human nature can provide insight into language, thought, social life, and morality, Part 4, and how it can clarify controversies on politics, violence, gender, child-rearing, and the arts, Part 5. Finally, I will show how the passing of the blank slate is less disquieting and in some ways less revolutionary than it first appears, Part 6. Chapter 1. The Official Theory. Blank slate is a loose translation of the medieval Latin term tabula rasa, literally, scraped tablet. It is commonly attributed to the philosopher John Locke, 1632-1704, though in fact he used a different metaphor. Here is the famous passage from An Essay Concerning Human Understanding. "Let us then suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on it, with an almost endless variety? Whence has it all the materials of reason and knowledge? To this I answer, in one word, from experience." Locke was taking aim at theories of innate ideas, in which people were thought to be born with mathematical ideals, eternal truths, and a notion of God. His alternative theory, empiricism, was intended both as a theory of psychology, how the mind works, and as a theory of epistemology, how we come to know the truth. Both goals helped motivate his political philosophy, often honored as the foundation of liberal democracy. Locke opposed dogmatic justifications for the political status quo, such as the authority of the church and the divine right of kings, which had been touted as self-evident truths. He argued that social arrangements should be reasoned out from scratch and agreed upon by mutual consent, based on knowledge that any person could acquire. Since ideas are grounded in experience, which varies from person to person, differences of opinion arise not because one mind is equipped to grasp the truth and another is defective, but because the two minds have had different histories. Those differences, therefore, ought to be tolerated rather than suppressed. Locke's notion of a blank slate also undermined a hereditary royalty and aristocracy, whose members could claim no innate wisdom or merit if their minds had started out as blank as everyone else's. It also spoke against the institution of slavery, because slaves could no longer be thought of as innately inferior or subservient. During the past century, the doctrine of the blank slate has set the agenda for much of the social sciences and humanity. As we shall see, psychology has sought to explain all thought, feeling, and behavior with a few simple mechanisms of learning. The social sciences have sought to explain all customs and social arrangements as a product of the socialization of children by the surrounding culture, a system of words, images, stereotypes, role models, and contingencies of reward and punishment. A long and growing list of concepts that would seem natural to the human way of thinking, emotions, kinship, the sexes, illness, nature, the world, are now said to have been invented or socially constructed. The blank slate has also served as a sacred scripture for political and ethical beliefs. According to the doctrine, any differences we see among races, ethnic groups, sexes, and individuals come not from differences in their innate constitution, but from differences in their experiences. Change the experiences by reforming parenting, education, the media, and social rewards, and you can change the person. Underachievement, poverty, and antisocial behavior can be ameliorated. Indeed, it is irresponsible not to do so. And discrimination on the basis of purportedly inborn traits of a sex or ethnic group is simply irrational. The blank slate is often accompanied by two other doctrines, which have also attained a sacred status in modern intellectual life. My label for the first of the two is commonly attributed to the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712-1778, though it really comes from John Dryden's The Conquest of Granada, published in 1670. "I am as free as nature first made man, ere the base laws of servitude began, when wild in woods the noble savage ran." The concept of the noble savage was inspired by European colonists' discovery of indigenous peoples in the Americas, Africa, and later, Oceania. It captures the belief that humans in their natural state are selfless, peaceable, and untroubled, and that blights such as greed, anxiety, and violence are the products of civilization. In 1755, Rousseau wrote, "So many authors have hastily concluded that man is naturally cruel, and requires a regular system of police to be reclaimed, whereas nothing can be more gentle than him in his primitive state, when placed by nature at an equal distance from the stupidity of brutes and the pernicious good sense of civilized man. The more we reflect on this state, the more convinced we shall be that it was the least subject of any two revolutions, the best for man, and that nothing could have drawn him out of it but some fatal accident, which, for the public good, should never have happened. The example of the savages, most of whom have been found in this condition, seems to confirm that mankind was formed ever to remain in it, that this condition is the real youth of the world, and that all ulterior improvements have been so many steps, in appearance towards the perfection of individuals, but in fact towards the decrepitness of the species." First among the authors that Rousseau had in mind was Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679, who had presented a very different picture. "Hereby it is manifest that during the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. In such condition there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. And the life of man? Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Hobbes believed that people could escape this hellish existence only by surrendering their autonomy to a sovereign person or assembly. He called it a leviathan, the Hebrew word for a monstrous sea creature subdued by Yahweh at the dawn of creation. Much depends on which of these armchair anthropologists is correct. If people are noble savages, then a domineering leviathan is unnecessary. Indeed, by forcing people to delineate private property for the state to recognize, property they might otherwise have shared, the leviathan creates the very greed and belligerence it is designed to control. A happy society would be our birthright. All we would need to do is eliminate the institutional barriers that keep it from us. If, in contrast, people are naturally nasty, the best we can hope for is an uneasy truce enforced by police and the army. The two theories have implications for private life as well. Every child is born a savage, that is, uncivilized. So if savages are naturally gentle, child-rearing is a matter of providing children with opportunities to develop their potential, and evil people are products of a society that has corrupted them. If savages are naturally nasty, then child-rearing is an arena of discipline and conflict, and evil people are showing a dark side that was insufficiently tamed. The actual writings of philosophers are always more complex than the theories they come to symbolize in the textbooks. In reality, the views of Hobbes and Rousseau are not that far apart. Rousseau, like Hobbes, believed, incorrectly, that savages were solitary, without ties of love or loyalty, and without any industry or art. And he may have out-Hobbesed Hobbes in claiming that they did not even have language. Hobbes envisioned, indeed literally drew, his Leviathan as an embodiment of the collective will, which was vested in it by a kind of social contract. Rousseau's most famous work is called The Social Contract, and in it he calls on people to subordinate their interests to a general will. Nonetheless, Hobbes and Rousseau limed contrasting pictures of the state of nature that have inspired thinkers in the centuries since. No one can fail to recognize the influence of the doctrine of the noble savage in contemporary consciousness. We see it in the current respect for all things natural, natural foods, natural medicines, natural childbirth. And the distrust of the man-made, the unfashionability of authoritarian styles of child-rearing and education, and the understanding of social problems as reparable defects in our institutions, rather than as tragedies inherent to the human condition. The other sacred doctrine that often accompanies the blank slate is usually attributed to the scientist, mathematician, and philosopher René Descartes, 1596 to 1650. There is a great difference between mind and body, inasmuch as body is by nature always divisible, and the mind is entirely indivisible. When I consider the mind, that is to say, myself, inasmuch as I am only a thinking being, I cannot distinguish in myself any parts, but apprehend myself to be clearly one and entire. And though the whole mind seems to be united to the whole body, yet if a foot or an arm or some other part is separated from the body, I am aware that nothing has been taken from my mind. And the faculties of willing, feeling, conceiving, etc., cannot be properly speaking said to be its parts, for it is one and the same mind which employs itself in willing and in feeling and understanding. But it is quite otherwise with corporeal or extended objects, for there is not one of them imaginable by me which my mind cannot easily divide into parts. This would be sufficient to teach me that the mind or soul of man is entirely different from the body, if I had not already been apprised of it on other grounds. A memorable name for this doctrine was given 3 centuries later by a detractor, the philosopher Gilbert Ryle, 1900 to 1976. There is a doctrine about the nature and place of minds which is so prevalent among theorists and even among laymen that it deserves to be described as the official theory. The official doctrine, which hails chiefly from Descartes, is something like this. With the doubtful exception of idiots and infants in arms, every human being has both a body and a mind. Some would prefer to say that every human being is both a body and a mind. His body and his mind are ordinarily harnessed together. But after the death of the body, his mind may continue to exist and function. Human bodies are in space and are subject to mechanical laws which govern all other bodies in space. But minds are not in space, nor are their operations subject to mechanical laws. Such an outline is the official theory. I shall often speak of it with deliberate abusiveness as the dogma of the ghost in the machine. The ghost in the machine, like the noble savage, arose in part as a reaction to Hobbes. Hobbes had argued that life and mind could be explained in mechanical terms. Light sets our nerves and brain in motion, and that is what it means to see. The motions may persist like the wake of a ship or the vibration of a plucked string, and that is what it means to imagine. Quantities get added or subtracted in the brain, and that is what it means to think. Descartes rejected the idea that the mind could operate by physical principles. He thought that behavior, especially speech, was not caused by anything but freely chosen. He observed that our consciousness, unlike our bodies and other physical objects, does not feel as if it is divisible into parts or laid out in space. He noted that we cannot doubt the existence of our minds, indeed, we cannot doubt that we are our minds, because the very act of thinking presupposes that our minds exist. But we can doubt the existence of our bodies, because we can imagine ourselves to be immaterial spirits who merely dream or hallucinate that we are incarnate. Descartes also found a moral bonus in his dualism, the belief that the mind is a different kind of thing from the body. There is none which is more effectual in leading feeble spirits from the straight path of virtue than to imagine that the soul of the brute is of the same nature as our own, and that in consequence, after this life we have nothing to fear or to hope for, any more than the flies and the ants. Ryle explains Descartes' dilemma. When Galileo showed that his methods of scientific discovery were competent to provide a mechanical theory, which should cover every occupant of space, Descartes found in himself two conflicting motives. As a man of scientific genius, he could not but endorse the claims of mechanics. Yet as a religious and moral man, he could not accept, as Hobbes accepted, the discouraging rider to those claims, namely that human nature differs only in degree of complexity from clockwork. It can indeed be upsetting to think of ourselves as glorified gears and springs. Machines are insensate, built to be used and disposable. Humans are sentient, possessing of dignity and rights, and infinitely precious. A machine has some workaday purpose, such as grinding grain or sharpening pencils. A human being has higher purposes, such as love, worship, good works, and the creation of knowledge and beauty. The behavior of machines is determined by the ineluctable laws of physics and chemistry. The behavior of people is freely chosen. With choice comes freedom, and therefore optimism about our possibilities for the future. With choice also comes responsibility, which allows us to hold people accountable for their actions. And of course, if the mind is separate from the body, it can continue to exist when the body breaks down, and our thoughts and pleasures will not someday be snuffed out forever. As I mentioned, most Americans continue to believe in an immortal soul, made of some non-physical substance which can part company with the body. But even those who do not avow that belief in so many words still imagine that somehow there must be more to us than electrical and chemical activity in the brain. Choice, dignity, and responsibility are gifts that set off human beings from everything else in the universe and seem incompatible with the idea that we are mere collections of molecules. Attempts to explain behavior in mechanistic terms are commonly denounced as reductionist or determinist. The denouncers rarely know exactly what they mean by those words, but everyone knows they refer to something bad. The dichotomy between mind and body also pervades everyday speech, as when we say, use your head, when we refer to out-of-body experiences, and when we speak of John's body, or for that matter, John's brain, which presupposes an owner, John, that is somehow separate from the brain it owns. Journalists sometimes speculate about brain transplants when they really should be calling them body transplants because, as the philosopher Dan Dennett has noted, this is the one transplant operation in which it is better to be the donor than the recipient. The doctrines of the blank slate, the noble savage, and the ghost in the machine, or as philosophers call them, empiricism, romanticism, and dualism, are logically independent, but in practice they are often found together. If the slate is blank, then strictly speaking it has neither injunctions to do good nor injunctions to do evil. But good and evil are asymmetrical. There are more ways to harm people than to help them, and harmful acts can hurt them to a greater degree than virtuous acts can make them better off. So a blank slate, compared with one filled with motives, is bound to impress us more by its inability to do harm than by its inability to do good. Rousseau did not literally believe in a blank slate, but he did believe that bad behavior is a product of learning and socialization. Men are wicked, he wrote. A sad and constant experience makes proof unnecessary. But this wickedness comes from society. There is no original perversity in the human heart. There is not a single vice to be found in it, of which it cannot be said how and whence it entered. If the metaphors in everyday speech are a clue, then all of us, like Rousseau, associate blankness with virtue rather than with nothingness. Think of the moral connotations of the adjectives: clean, fair, immaculate, lily-white, pure, spotless, unmarred, and unsullied, and of the nouns blemish, blot, mark, stain, and taint. The blank slate naturally coexists with the ghost in the machine, too, since a slate that is blank is a hospitable place for a ghost to haunt. If a ghost is to be at the controls, the factory can ship the device with a minimum of parts. The ghost can read the body's display panels and pull its levers, with no need for a high-tech executive program, guidance system, or CPU. The more not clockwork there is controlling behavior, the less clockwork we need to posit. For similar reasons, the ghost in the machine happily accompanies the noble savage. If the machine behaves ignobly, we can blame the ghost, which freely chose to carry out the iniquitous acts. We need not probe for a defect in the machine's design. Philosophy today gets no respect. Many scientists use the term as a synonym for effete speculation. When my colleague Ned Block told his father that he would major in the subject, his father's reply was Luft, Yiddish for air. And then there's the joke in which a young man told his mother he would become a doctor of philosophy, and she said, "Wonderful, but what kind of disease is philosophy?" But far from being idle or airy, the ideas of philosophers can have repercussions for centuries. The blank slate and its companion doctrines have infiltrated the conventional wisdom of our civilization and have repeatedly surfaced in unexpected places. William Godwin, 1756 to 1835, one of the founders of liberal political philosophy, wrote that children are a sort of raw material put into our hands. Their minds, like a sheet of white paper. More sinisterly, we find Mao Zedong justifying his radical social engineering by saying, "It is on a blank page that the most beautiful poems are written." Even Walt Disney was inspired by the metaphor. "I think of a child's mind as a blank book," he wrote. "During the first years of his life, much will be written on the pages. The quality of that writing will affect his life profoundly." Locke could not have imagined that his words would someday lead to Bambi, intended by Disney to teach self-reliance. Nor could Rousseau have anticipated Pocahontas, the ultimate noble savage. Indeed, the soul of Rousseau seems to have been channeled by the writer of a recent Thanksgiving op-ed piece in the Boston Globe. I would submit that the world Native Americans knew was more stable, happier, and less barbaric than our society today. There were no employment problems. Community harmony was strong. Substance abuse unknown. Crime nearly non-existent. What warfare there was between tribes was largely ritualistic and seldom resulted in indiscriminate or wholesale slaughter. While there were hard times, life was, for the most part, stable and predictable. Because the native people respected what was around them, there was no loss of water or food resources because of pollution or extinction, no lack of materials for the daily essentials, such as baskets, canoes, shelter, or firewood. The third doctrine, too, continues to make its presence felt in modern times. In 2001, George W. Bush announced that the American government will not fund research on human embryonic stem cells if scientists have to destroy new embryos to extract them. The policy permits research on stem cell lines that were previously extracted from embryos. He derived the policy after consulting not just with scientists, but with philosophers and religious thinkers. Many of them framed the moral problem in terms of ensoulment, the moment at which the cluster of cells that will grow into a child is endowed with a soul. Some argued that ensoulment occurs at conception, which implies that the blastocyst, the five-day-old ball of cells from which stem cells are taken, is morally equivalent to a person, and that destroying it is a form of murder. That argument proved decisive, which means that American policy on perhaps the most promising medical technology of the 21st century was decided by pondering the moral issue as it might have been framed centuries before. When does the ghost first enter the machine? There are just a few of the fingerprints of the blank slate The Noble Savage, and The Ghost in the Machine on Modern Intellectual Life. In the following chapters, we will see how the seemingly airy ideas of Enlightenment philosophers entrenched themselves in modern consciousness, and how recent discoveries are casting those ideas in doubt. Chapter 2. Silly Putty. The Danish philologist Otto Jespersen, 1860-1943, is one of history's most beloved linguists. His vivid books are still read today, especially Growth and Structure of the English Language, first published in 1905. Though Jespersen's scholarship is thoroughly modern, the opening pages remind us we are not reading a contemporary book. There is one expression that continually comes to my mind whenever I think of the English language and compare it with others. It seems to be positively and expressly masculine. It is the language of a grown-up man and has very little childish or feminine about it. To bring out one of these points, I select at random, by way of contrast, a passage from the language of Hawaii. Ikona hiki ana aku, ilela, ua hukipa, ia mae laoia, me ke aloa pumihana loa. Thus it goes on. No single word ends in a consonant, and a group of two or more consonants is never found. Can anyone be in doubt that even if such a language sounds pleasantly and be full of music and harmony, the total impression is childlike and effeminate? You do not expect much vigor or energy in a people speaking such a language. It seems adapted only to inhabitants of sunny regions where the soil requires scarcely any labor on the part of man to yield him everything he wants, and where life, therefore, does not bear the stamp of a hard struggle against nature and fellow creatures. In a lesser degree, we find the same phonetic structure in such languages as Italian and Spanish, but how different are our northern tongues. And so he continues, advertising the virility, sobriety, and logic of English, and ends the chapter. As the language is, so also is the nation. No modern reader can fail to be shocked by the sexism, racism, and chauvinism of the discussion. The implication that women are childlike, the stereotyping of a colonized people as indolent, the gratuitous exalting of the author's own culture. Equally surprising are the sorry standards to which the great scholar here has sunk. The suggestion that a language can be grown up and masculine is so subjective as to be meaningless. He attributes a personality trait to an entire people without any evidence, then advances two theories, that phonology reflects personality and that warm climates breed laziness, without invoking even correlational data, let alone proof of causation. Even on his home ground, the reasoning is flimsy. Languages with a consonant-vowel-syllable structure, like Hawaiian, call for longer words to convey the same amount of information. Hardly what you would expect in a people without vigor or energy. And the consonant-encrusted syllables of English are liable to be swallowed and misheard. Hardly what you would expect from a logical, business-like people. But perhaps most disturbing is Jespersen's obliviousness to the possibility that he might be saying anything exceptional. He took it for granted that his biases would be shared by his readers, whom he knew to be fellow men and speakers of our northern tongues. "Can anyone be in doubt?" he asked rhetorically. "You do not expect much vigor from such a people," he asserted. The inferiority of women and other races needed neither justification nor apology. I bring up Otto Jespersen, a man of his time, to show how standards have changed. The passage is a random sample of intellectual life a century ago. Equally disturbing passages could have been taken from just about any writer of the 19th or early 20th century. It was a time of white men taking up the burden of leading their new-caught, sullen peoples, half-devil and half-child. Of shores teeming with huddled masses and wretched refuse. Of European imperial powers looking, and sometimes throwing, daggers at one another. imperialism, immigration, nationalism, and the legacy of slavery made differences between ethnic groups all too obvious. Some appeared educated and cultured, others ignorant and backward. Some used fists and clubs to preserve their safety. Others paid the police and the army to do it. It was tempting to assume that Northern Europeans were an advanced race suited to rule the others. Just as convenient was the belief that women were constitutionally suited for the kitchen, church, and children, a belief supported by research, showing that brain work was bad for their physical and mental health. Racial prejudice, too, had a scientific patina. Darwin's theory of evolution was commonly misinterpreted as an explanation of intellectual and moral progress, rather than an explanation of how living things adapt to an ecological niche. The non-white races, it was easy to think, were rungs on an evolutionary ladder between the apes and the Europeans. Worse, Darwin's follower Herbert Spencer wrote that do-gooders would only interfere with the progress of evolution if they tried to improve the lot of the impoverished classes and races who were, in Spencer's view, biologically less fit. The doctrine of social Darwinism, or as it ought to be called, social Spencerism, for Darwin wanted no part of it, attracted such unsurprising spokesmen as John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, had suggested that human evolution should be given a helping hand by discouraging the less fit from breeding, a policy he called eugenics. Within a few decades, laws were passed that called for the involuntary sterilization of delinquents and the feeble-minded in Canada, the Scandinavian countries, 30 American states, and, ominously, Germany. The Nazis' ideology of inferior races was later used to justify the murder of millions of Jews, gypsies, and homosexuals. We have come a long way. Though attitudes far worse than Jesperson's continue to thrive in much of the world and in parts of our society, they have been driven out of mainstream intellectual life in Western democracy. Today, no respectable figure in the United States, Britain, or Western Europe can casually insult women or sling around invidious stereotypes of other races or ethnic groups. Educated people try to be conscious of their hidden prejudices and to measure them against the facts and against the sensibilities of others. In public life, we try to judge people as individuals, not as specimens of a sex or ethnic group. We try to distinguish might from right, and our parochial tastes from objective merit, and therefore respect cultures that are different or poorer than ours. We realize that no Mandarin is wise enough to be entrusted with directing the evolution of the species, and that it is wrong in any case for the government to interfere with such a personal decision as having a child. The very idea that the members of an ethnic group should be persecuted because of their biology fills us with revulsion. These changes were cemented by the bitter lessons of lynchings, world wars, forced sterilizations, and the Holocaust, which showcased the grave implications of denigrating an ethnic group. But they emerged earlier in the 20th century, the spin-off of an unplanned experiment. The massive immigration, social mobility, and diffusion of knowledge of the modern era. Most Victorian gentlemen could not have imagined that the coming century would see a nation-state forged by Jewish pioneers and soldiers, a wave of African-American public intellectuals, or a software industry in Bangalore. Nor could they have anticipated that women would lead nations in wars, run huge corporations, or win Nobel Prizes in science. We now know that people of both sexes and all races are capable of attaining any station in life. This sea change included a revolution in the treatment of human nature by scientists and scholars. Academics were swept along by the changing attitudes to race and sex, but they also helped to direct the tide by holding forth on human nature in books and magazines, and by lending their expertise to government agencies. The prevailing theories of mind were refashioned to make racism and sexism as untenable as possible. The doctrine of the blank slate became entrenched in intellectual life, in a form that has been called the Standard Social Science Model, or Social Constructionism. The model is now second nature to people, and few are aware of the history behind it. Carl Degler, the foremost historian of this revolution, sums it up this way. What the available evidence does seem to show